Breakthrough.
You are now listening to Breakthrough News. It's 5 p.m. You're listening to Breakthrough News, and this is The Punch Out. We're following the news all day so you don't have to, giving you everything you need to know about what's in the headlines and what should be. And yes, we are back here on The Punch Out, 10th of August, 2021. Very happy to be back here with you on the show. Plenty for you on the show, as we always do have for you. We're going to be talking about CEO pay here in the United States skyrocketing, the Taliban's offensive in Afghanistan. But before we get to either of those two very important stories, we're going to start with the various infrastructure and budget bills that are making their way through the United States Senate right now. Well, the U.S. Senate seems to be reaching the end game as it concerns the so-called bipartisan infrastructure bill, and also starting to get closer to pushing forward the Democrats-only budget reconciliation bill that deals with a wider range of concerns, but also some infrastructure. On the one hand, the two bills are being touted as the largest investments ever in certain priorities, but on the other, they represent a relatively moderate approach, and as it concerns the infrastructure bill, an extremely moderate approach when compared to the actual scale of the problems that they are purporting to solve. There is also still the issue of what exactly can even pass both houses of Congress, so while there's quite a bit of reporting around the fact that various deals are imminent, how imminent is yet to be seen. The infrastructure bill is right now the highest profile item and set to potentially go to a vote this week at some point, perhaps even as soon as today. There seems to be really only delays left, but a quote unquote yes vote, if you will, in the Senate seems certain with at least 10 Republicans. And judging by the various procedural votes leading to this moment, close to 20 GOP members may ultimately sign on. So as President Biden has said, he wanted all along with an infrastructure package, it is indeed bipartisan. What's important to recognize here is that the only way a bipartisan compromise was reached was through a group of moderate senators and both parties agreeing to not do enough to actually meet the U.S.'s infrastructure needs. Led by Kristen Sinema of Arizona on the Democratic side and Rob Portman of Ohio on the Republican side, the central organizing principle of this bill is no new taxes. Now, the main stumbling block between President Biden's original and more ambitious American Jobs Plan and this final product was how it was going to be paid for. Biden and some Democrats were originally proposing very modest tax increases on super profitable megacorporations and high net worth individuals who saw their wealth increase astronomically during the pandemic. Republicans and also some Democrats and major business lobbies like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the Business Roundtable balked at that and refused to support anything that would take a cent from the massive profits of corporations and fat bank accounts of billionaires. And just to give you a sense of how absurd this all is, in the second quarter of this year, corporations spent $484 billion in share buybacks, essentially just handing money over to Wall Street investors. And in that same quarter, rich Americans spent $600 billion borrowing money from banks to avoid having to pay taxes on their massive capital gains. To put that in perspective, the total amount needed to clear the backlog of all bridge repairs in the United States is $125 billion. It would cost $21 billion to improve and maintain moderate, high, and very high-risk levees in the United States. There's a $70 billion backlog in repairs at the public housing developments that are all across the United States, and it would cost $66 billion to bring all the nation's dams into the right level of maintenance and repair. Just to note here, I'm only at $282 billion so far. So you could fix all the bridges, dams, levees, and public housing in the United States for just over half of what major corporations spent enriching Wall Street investors in the first 4 months of the year. Just to throw that in there, according to Biden's plan, it would cost $100 billion to have broadband infrastructure that covers the entire country. So we aren't even up to $400 billion, and we've already fixed the bridges, dams, levees, public housing, and brought broadband to every corner of the nation. So again, ridiculous, they wouldn't raise taxes on the ultra rich. None of this reality even mattered. The bipartisan group just moved forward, pushing a bill that makes sure the wealthiest don't have to pay a dime. So ultimately, we've ended up with a bill that doesn't really come close to what's required. For instance, it provides $40 billion specifically for bridge repair. Well, as we stated above, we need $125 billion. And invest $65 billion in electricity infrastructure. According to the American Society of Civil Engineers, we need $197 billion. The plan touts $89 billion in investment for public transit as the largest investment of this type ever. Well, there's currently a $176 billion backlog in bringing public transit infrastructure back into proper repair, a deficit that's expected to grow to as much as $270 billion during the 10-year period that this bill doles out its funding. The boosters of the infrastructure bill tout $55 billion in there to help make sure everyone has clean water, free especially from lead. Well, the funding gap for water infrastructure is $434 billion. The White House fact sheet on the bill notes that it'll spend $5 billion on electric buses. Well, China, which has over 400,000 electric buses compared to the 1,600 in the United States, has spent literally tens of billions of dollars, perhaps as much as $63 billion, according to my calculations, to get to where they are. I could go on, but you get the gist. You could, of course, say, well, hey, something is better than nothing, and while there, of course, may be a kernel of truth there, in reality, this bill is almost perverse in its inadequacy. It literally was written without any relationship to the problems it's addressing. It is organized purely around the principle of only doing as much as they can do without making rich people make any sort of extra contribution over their existing very low taxes right now. It literally is a principle of lawmaking that openly ignores reality. Amazing, really, that the richest country in the history of countries would rather let some bridges collapse and some kids be poisoned by lead rather than have billionaires pay more taxes. This, of course, is so ridiculous that Democrats have teed up another bill in the Senate, a $3.5 trillion plan that will be passed through the budget reconciliation process, which allows them to pass it without any Republicans who oppose the bill wholesale anyway. Now, one thing that is important to realize about this bill is that $3.5 trillion is just a number, and the details and the number itself are still up in the air. But as laid out so far with the $3.5 trillion and the broader framework that was released of some of what they might spend it on, does address a number of important issues. And also, just for the record, the main authors of that bill are Bernie Sanders of Vermont and Mark Warner of Virginia. But this budget reconciliation bill will finally establish a paid family and medical leave program in the United States, provide universal pre-K and 2 free years of community college, expand Medicare to dental and vision, and also lower the eligibility age for Medicare, provide more funding for long-term care for seniors and people with disabilities, permanently expand the child care tax credit in place right now that could reduce child poverty by 40%. It also addresses the shameful repair backlog in public housing and provides billions of dollars in funding for violence interruption programs that could reduce the scope of policing in many of the most over-policed neighborhoods around the country. It would also pass the PRO Act, strengthening unions, and invest various dollars in various places to reach an 80% clean electricity and 50% reduction on carbon emissions by 2030. It's an 80% clean electricity standard, 50% reduction on carbon emissions by 2030. So without a doubt, a much better effort that would make a meaningful difference in the life of all working class people, particularly families and seniors. The bill also does propose higher taxes on those who can most afford to pay for these things. So it also breaks away from the unreality that was governing the infrastructure bill, or is governing the infrastructure bill. Now, of course, there's a subsidiary question here about the adequacy of this plan as well. For instance, clearly healthcare would be much better improved through Medicare for All rather than a limited expansion of Medicare and an expansion of subsidies to health insurance companies. Or there's also the fact that this bill, like the infrastructure bill, by the way, rests very heavily on electric cars as a major answer in terms of reducing the impacts of climate change. But electric cars require fewer workers to assemble. Without some form of planning, how could you do such a thing without serious unemployment and poverty increases among auto workers? On the same token here, you could also ask, should the bulk of affordable housing funding, hundreds of billions of dollars proposed here, just be given out as subsidies to private developers as currently proposed? Or should we instead, through planning and social housing, make sure everyone absolutely has a roof over their head? So clearly there's a lot that could be improved right here. In many ways, the budget reconciliation bill is also wanting. But it is unequivocal that the budget reconciliation bill is a significant reform, which does represent a political reaction to the rising tide of protest and organizing around issues of concern to working poor and oppressed people. Now, the final question, of course, is how much of any of this will actually happen. Well, the infrastructure bill seems like it's guaranteed to pass the Senate, but that's where things start to become more complicated. In the House, it seems a number of Democrats, enough to scuttle the bill, are unwilling to vote for it unless the budget reconciliation bill has also passed at the $3.5 trillion level. But in the Senate, it isn't clear that there are 50 votes for the $3.5 trillion proposal. So ultimately, it may be difficult to pass both bills through both houses because moderate Democrats insist on watering down the budget reconciliation bill. Tough to say how this is all exactly going to play out, but it does seem that because of the fact that the real majority in the Senate is the billionaire caucus that refuses to demand any obligations on the ultra-rich, any positive action of any kind is at risk of just not happening at all. Moderation madness, truly holding the country hostage. The Taliban is, militarily at least, on a roll in Afghanistan, taking 6 provincial capitals in the last 4 days, adding significant urban areas to their functional control of most of the country's rural territory. And the battle continues around Afghanistan's second largest city of Kandahar, which many feel could fall soon. The situation is serious enough that the United States Air Force has brought out B-52 bombers and AC-130 Spectre gunships to try to shore up the Afghan government forces. At least 244,000 people have been displaced since the beginning of May, when the Taliban began making a strong push to control territory on the ground. The U.S. negotiators who work with the Taliban on the withdrawal deal that will see U.S. troops leave next month on September 11th are apparently pleading with the Taliban to stop the offensive. Taliban leaders have been releasing messages calling on their forces not to engage in reprisal killings against Afghan government forces and generally just be on their best behavior when they overrun cities and towns. Clearly, the Taliban is aiming to have as much control as possible in whatever government emerges post-U.S. withdrawal. They have a bit of a diplomatic issue here. Clearly, they would like to be the sole power, but most regional nations, including China and Iran, as well as the United States, not regional but still a player here, oppose this and have made it clear that they want to see something worked out between the two sides. So the Taliban is trying to create a fait accompli on the ground, which allows them to sideline the government forces and establish a fig leaf coalition government. To seize sole power would make it difficult for them to keep other powerful nations from intervening in various ways that could hamstring their ability to govern. The Taliban has, for instance, expressed interest in Chinese-funded economic projects, something less likely to happen if they don't at least pretend to not be taking sole power. The military situation is also a clear reflection of how totally futile the U.S. occupation was. After 20 years and nearly $900 billion, the Afghan government appears to not be able to hold any significant territory, and their military, supposedly hundreds of thousands strong, is obviously totally inept. And honestly, this is no real surprise. It's been clear for years that the so-called government was just a colonial administration that could not exist outside of significant U.S. boots on the ground. For what it's worth, the so-called government is blaming Pakistan for the Taliban offensive, but that seems as much of an excuse as a real explanation for the success of the Taliban offensive. Almost certainly, the Taliban will continue their offensive in the coming days and probably seize more cities and towns and wait for a full U.S. withdrawal to propose a final agreement with the de facto Afghan government, where that de facto government will have very little choice but to accept whatever terms are on offer from the Taliban. Well, may not surprise you to hear that during the same period where workers' wages barely rose over the past few decades, that CEO pay in the United States skyrocketed. New research from the Economic Policy Institute has detailed that from 1978 to 2020, CEO pay grew by 1,322%, while, in contrast, compensation of the typical worker grew by just 18%. The report also notes that, quote, the CEO to worker compensation ratio was 21 to 1 in 1965. It peaked at 366 to 1 in 2000, and in 2020, the ratio was 351 to 1. Most important, the ratio was far higher than at any point in the 1960s, 1970s, 1980s, or 1990s. They also further note that, quote, the dramatic increase in CEO compensation during the pandemic is remarkable. While millions were out of work, CEOs realized compensation jumped 18.9% in just 1 year. Typical worker compensation of those who remained employed did rise 3.9% over 2020. Even that wage growth, though, is overstated. Perversely, high job loss among low-wage workers skewed the average wage higher. And the report goes on to note that CEO pay grew 60% faster than the stock market did from 1978 until last year, which at least implies that CEO pay far outstrips any actual increase in corporate performance. They also noted that last year in 2020, 83% of CEO pay was in stock options, meaning that it's taxed at a lower level than if they were paid the same amount of money as a salary. And that, of course, is if it's even taxed at all, given the huge amount of tax dodges out there. Even more perverse, CEOs that engage in stock buybacks to make their stock more valuable to Wall Street investors are actually able to boost their own income massively. So that's America for you. Over the past four decades, CEOs see their income go up 1,300%, while average workers saw at most an 18% increase. That's the punch out for today. We're with you Monday through Friday, 5 p.m. here in New York, East Coast Standard Time, 2 p.m. in Los Angeles, Pacific Standard Time, and 9 p.m. GMT. And of course, you can support everything we do here at Breakthrough News at patreon.com/breakthroughnews. It's your patronage that keeps all of our offerings here at Breakthrough News moving forward. And of course, you can check us out across all your social media platforms, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, at BT Newsroom.